his bird note. Birds migrating through your area, like this yellow warbler, benefit from native plants in backyards and parks that offer food and shelter. When you provide places for migratory birds to rest and refuel, you're helping them complete their long journeys and reach their destination safely. In a similar way, BirdNote also relies on your generosity. As an independent nonprofit, we depend on support from listeners like you to keep us going. This week, we're asking you to make a donation of any amount at birdnote.org to help us continue sharing the joy and wonder of birds with people everywhere. Much like the satisfaction you get from helping out your local birds and seeing them around the neighborhood, supporting BirdNote is a reward that keeps giving. Every time you hear the show, you'll know that you helped bring BirdNote to millions of people all over the world. Our show takes flight on the airwaves every day, and it all begins with your support. Help us continue the journey by visiting birdnote.org and making a donation now. That's birdnote.org. With gratitude from all of us at BirdNote, I'm Michael Stein.
CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Supported and empowered by the students of SFU and listeners like you. For your community, by your community. You are CJSF.
Hello, and welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. My name is Hale, and with me again is Brandon. We're going to be doing a show about learning and doing philosophy, and really talking, rather than, you know, as many of our listeners may know, many of our episodes are focused on a specific philosophical topic or reading or whatever. This one is going to be more anecdotal. It's going to be more of a reflection on what learning and doing philosophy has looked like for us, and sort of processes and functionalities and what we have found works and doesn't work and all that kind of stuff. So it'll be interesting, especially for those of you who are currently like engaged with philosophy or just trying to get into it, or really any sort of intellectual topic, right? This kind of goes across the board. How do you engage with it like an art, effectively?
Yeah, I always find it really interesting getting to sort of peek behind the veil when professors and, you know, people who do this stuff for a living, when they talk shop, you really get to see what they do and what works for them and what doesn't. And even if some things don't necessarily work out for their students or for the people who are listening in, it's good to know that that's a practice someone has tried. It does this for this kind of person. It's worth trying because the people who are successful or who are doing this for a living are trying it out. So I find these things generally pretty illuminating and also kind of telling of the character of the person doing the reading and explaining the way that they approach things, because philosophy is it's a strange discipline where it's not just the content that you engage with and you study that shows how you think. It's how you engage with it that also shows how you think and how you engage with it as well.
Yeah, and I'm sure we'll have quite a bit to say in terms of engaging with the content. You know, I know a lot of profs and super philosophical people, you know, for a long time, especially those rooted in the more traditional sense, you know, really emphasize engaging with original works and sort of like slowly working through that stuff, which is and the kind of drudgery and difficulty of doing that, which is really transposed against like more modern ways of doing philosophy through like modern mediums that you and I have really talked about since we've many of our listeners probably know, Brandon and I love doing philosophy of media shows and going into that kind of stuff. And, you know, how learning and doing philosophy has changed within new mediums and what that kind of looks like, obviously, with, you know, things like, you know, YouTube and Instagram and shorts and all this kind of stuff, where you see this philosophical content reworked into things like tweets or little clips or like whatever, right? Whether or not that's like, I think both of us are a little like skeptical of all that kind of stuff, but it is certainly a way in which philosophy is happening in some sense.
And it's not unprecedented for philosophy to find itself in all kinds of different forms, right? It's worth engaging with how philosophy is being done, why it's being done in these ways, what the medial effect is of doing philosophy in these ways.
But before we get into like what those effects might be and also like what our own experiences have been with just like doing philosophy, why don't we do our little quote and quandary section? This is our little opener. We've been doing this for a couple months now. Where we look at a quote, we each bring a quote, we can just kind of discuss it or a passage or whatever. And we also have a quandary, a question, something we've been thinking about, something kind of philosophically interesting that we've noticed that we just kind of want to bring to briefly to attention.
I think I've mentioned this multiple times, but it's worth reiterating that I got this from a book on a free book pile. Someone had put out the Prose and Poetry of Lord Byron, who was an English romantic poet. And this is from his letters. He says, "The great object of life is sensation, to feel that we exist, even though in pain. It is this craving void which drives us to gaming, to battle, to travel, to intemperate but keenly felt pursuits of every description, whose principal attraction is the agitation inseparable from their accomplishment." I find it a bit verbose, but I at the same time find that there's something useful about the way that it kind of carries on. The subject matter itself kind of explains, or there's like particular topics or areas that Byron is saying that people are driven to gaming, to battle, to travel. But then he also lists the quality of these things, which again, I'm trying to kind of parse out what this means, but I think I understand a little bit, where he says, "The principal attraction is the agitation inseparable from their accomplishment." So let's take traveling. We go and we accomplish traveling. Well, there's some agitation that just accomplishing going somewhere causes in us to continue to do this, that life goes, like, there is this continued drive to evoke these sensations, right? As Byron says, to feel that we exist, that this is the feeling of existence, the continual perpetuation of sensations.
Yeah, I actually think this is a great quote for you to bring up. I guess it is a comment in a way as well. It's a quote and a comment. But I think, you know, turning 30, I've been reflecting upon my own intellectual life and pursuits more and more. And one thing I've kind of noticed about myself is that I've always been a bit of an absorber or a thinker and a doer, but not so much of a creative. And I've felt that energy has long been like inside of me, but not, I haven't been actualizing that and pushing that. And I could see what Byron is getting at there, where there's this kind of inner agitation to like put oneself out into the world. And there's a way in which like doing philosophy, at least like kind of reading and studying philosophy or whatever it might be, doesn't really successfully do that, because you're more like taking in sensation. Well, I guess it's like partly functional because it is like a kind of sensation, but you're not actually then like regurgitating and putting stuff out into the world unless you're also like writing and having unique thoughts and having new takes on stuff, instead of just like absorbing and taking stuff in from old masters and new works or whatever.
So Pythagoras says that life is like the Olympian Games. There's three kinds of people. There are the athletes who go and perform. Then there are the people who go to sell and hawk their merchandise among the crowd. The crowd is the most noble because they are the people who witness all the glory of this. So there is something, at least in the Pythagorean conception of philosophy, there is something purely passive about being a philosopher. They use the word theoria, which means to observe.
I've got a little, for my quote, it's a short passage from Ernest Hemingway's In Our Time. It's from a short story that he wrote. It's about a character called Nick. It's one of his earliest works. It's from like 1925 or something like that. And it's about this young kind of like gruff guy living on in a sort of like frontier town, you know, in the 1920s or whatever. And there's just a scene where he is walking on train tracks at night, trying to get from town to town in the evening, trying to get from one town to another. And he sees a little fire off to the side of these train tracks and walks down to the fire. And there's a little camp there. And he sees this guy who's a very kind of like rough looking. The guy's actually physically disabled, but he's a very, you know, kind of rough, hard scrabbled guy sitting by a fire by the side of the train tracks. And Nick goes up to him and kind of says like, hello or whatever. And then the man has this little phrasing. He says, so there's this little interaction between the two of them. The man says, listen, the little man said, this is the guy that Nick found. Listen, the little man said, I'm not quite right. Nick responded, what's the matter? He says, I'm crazy. He put on his cap. Nick felt like laughing. You're all right, Nick said. He said, no, I'm not. I'm crazy. Listen, you ever been crazy? No, said Nick. How does it get you? And then the man said, I don't know. When you got it, you don't know about it. So it was particularly that last phrasing. He said, I don't know. When you got it, I don't. When you got it, you don't know about it. This has been a long-standing kind of like side interest or something that I've kind of meditated on or whatever, which is basically the degradation of like mental states and the kind of like, obviously, as much as like I don't agree with some sort of like solipsistic vision of the world as like, you know, everything emanates from my own experience and blah 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 blah, but there is a way in which my individual experience as just one being, not counting basically some kind of objectivity, obviously focusing on my own subjectivity, you know, is very uniquely structured and coherent for me. And that I've always thought madness was an interesting philosophical study, because it's what happens when subjectivity breaks down and loses its coherence, loses its reliability. But it's also one in which, as you know, it kind of says, again, as the guy says here, when you got it, you don't know about it. There's also a way in which it becomes it's almost a little bit of a chimera, because you can't actually ever like grasp it. Like, how can you ever understand if you're always, you know, sort of projecting yourself out from your subjectivity, right? You're always living in your own narrative story, your own subjective life. Well, how can you know what it's like for, you know, on a phenomenologically speaking, for madness to set in when it's impossible to know about one's own subjectivity effectively degrading, rotting, falling apart, splintering into many pieces, however you want to think about it, without that actually happening? But if that's happening to you, then you're also losing the coherence to be reflective on the fact that that's happening. Now, obviously, people who have many types of mental illnesses and stuff like that, there can be some kind of awareness, and you kind of can go in and out of those states. But especially once you're in that state, I think it's very, you know, it's obviously very tragic, but it's certainly interesting to see how that becomes that chaotic, fragmented way of a subjective life, which is effectively a non-linear, non-narrative form of living, right? What I mean by non-narrative is like there's no longer everybody has a coherent, more or less coherent story of their life, right? Whether or not they're kind of like delusional about what that is, or it gets more complicated. But if you're really crazy, you don't, right? Like it begins to sort of jump all over the place, or just be completely made up, or, you know, just be completely sort of fanciful or whatever. But more often than not, my experience, especially working with people quite frequently with mental illness, is what it looks like more is more of a chaotic fragmentation. And so it's interesting to think about that. But then it also got me thinking about, you know, what does madness look like from its different origin points and the kind of different forms? And what I mean is, like, obviously there's like severe mental illness, right? That's like the most obvious one. And that's, you know, can happen from all sorts of different origin points have all sorts of different like efficient causes or whatever. I think there's also a way in which our own subjectivity, like obviously ourselves emanate from our subjectivity, where like in this space we know ourselves. It's like our, like I was saying, our, we live out our story. But there's a way in which our story also like kind of borders and structures. There's components, there's pieces of this, of the story that make it all sort of cohere and hang together. And once you start taking those pieces out, I think people start to, like I see people start to lose a sense of their, a sense of themselves as well. And I think the most obvious example of this, and I think the most disturbing on a wider societal level, is what happens with the elderly, and not necessarily just with people who have dementia, but people who are, you know, so old that they can't be taken, you know, the families don't feel like they can take care of them. Their social lives, like everybody that they kind of knew has passed away, their partners have passed away, their families put them in a home, et cetera, et cetera. Even if they don't necessarily have like something like dementia, you know, I have on multiple occasions witnessed people sort of break their mental state becomes much, much less like robust and self-aware and even active, right? Because the whole structures of their life, you know, the narrative structures have been sort of pulled out. So even if they're not like necessarily mentally ill, there's no longer this coherence there anymore as well. And they also don't seem to be like super necessarily self-aware of that all the time either, right? It's kind of like once you're in it again, like you're kind of like, oh, well, everything's gone.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the constitutive element of it, right? Like, as you were talking, I was thinking about, because I have like a minor interest in this, you know, kind of dabbling in like reading Freud and Winnicott and like the psychoanalytic literature. But this seems like something much different from the kind of neuroses that are constituted by things like repression. Repression being almost like a normal process of forming an identity, you know. Certain events happen, and it's not that we project meanings onto them. Certain meanings are only capable of arising in certain situations, but they're multifaceted, and repression is the capacity to essentially make a decision and move on from the other meanings that it could have been, right? You're shutting things off. You're ignoring things. People are repressing their identity in this way or that way. And that repression is possible because we can ignore. This seems a little different than just repression, though. This is a kind of rupture in a capacity to make the decisions to form an identity, right? If we go about living our lives by seeing the world in a certain light that lines up with certain continuity, madness in the way that you're describing seems to be like the losing the ability to form those linear lines that we set out to create for ourselves, or the sort of unraveling of that from, you know, one end to the other, from the past to the future. We are always kind of engaged in a certain amount of ignoring things in order to construct that continuity. And in that, and when things go wrong is, you know, when people run into problems and they no longer can sustain a self-conception in any given environment or something like that, they run into, you know, they start to show neurotic symptoms and stuff like that. But this is way different. This seems to be the onset of, you know, certain cognitive problems or physical problems where one loses one's autonomy over oneself in the elderly, but not necessarily it's demented.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think you came up with an excellent perspective, and I appreciate you bringing in people like Freud with it, because that's always like super super interesting. As you were speaking, like, you know, like my way of reinterpreting that and thinking about that is obviously going back to some like loosely some kind of existential phenomenological work, where it's like you start to see a draining of meaning from one's life in the world. And I don't just mean that in terms of like, oh, you know, I don't have, my kids are all grown up, like, what do I do with myself? I think it goes much deeper than that. Like, you know, where suddenly, like, you know, everything in the world, all objects, all entities, all beings, they all have a kind of referential framework that we've talked about before. This is something I kind of subscribe to a little bit, where, you know, everything has a kind of links and holds together in a way. Like, nothing is isolated in its meaning. You know, the example that I've used many times on the on the show is, you know, kind of saying like, try to think of something that's like nothing else, right? Like they're like, everything is going to have some sort of like reference point to everything, right? But I think that there's a point in which, you know, those reference points either stop making sense, like they literally like, or they refer to, they start becoming completely unique to the individual. And that's not necessarily a good thing, right? Like if you have, if points of reference are no longer communicable, they don't have, no longer have a shared point of language, because suddenly like, you know, like chair and hot air balloon are like connected in some sort of weird way, right? Like where you're like, every time you think you're interacting with a chair, like you're also interacting with hot air balloon. Like it's like, that's not good. Like you don't want that. But then there's also a point at which like those part of meaning is things having a kind of like vibrance to them, a kind of resonance. And it's almost like in the other point of a kind of like madness, a sort of slipping away of one's subjectivity from oneself is a slipping away of that vibrance, a slipping away of the kind of reverence that things have, where no longer anything kind of seems important, and no longer anything has like, nothing has a like for the sake of which, like nothing has a like a reason for being anymore, which sounds a lot like depression. And I think that like severe depression also eventually leads into a kind of madness, right? Where like the world is just like drained of all kind of color, all kind of resonance, right? And a person can't, is not like functional in that state, right? Like that's just not a, a state of being where people are like, not just like doing good. It's like, oh, you're not having a tough time. I mean, like literally like your cognitive abilities slip away.
Depression is, it can be depressing if you're doing philosophy about it and trying to phenomenologically explore it, because you kind of do have to put it on for a second. But at the same time, you know, you, if you have the, I guess, I don't want to say like if you have the skills to do phenomenology, or I should say if you've practiced it enough that you understand that there's a certain detachment you have to bring to these examinations, then you'll survive the encounter.
I was watching a YouTube video of a kind of comedian podcaster guy, Nick Mullen, who I quite like. He was in an interview, and he kind of, one of the things he pointed out, he was like, I don't know when the last time an ad ever, you know, induced me to buy something, right? He was like, I don't know the last time. And I kind of heard that, and I was like, Yeah, I agree. Like, I don't know the last time I saw an advertisement and I was like, yeah, I want that. Like, I need to get that thing, blah, blah. I think there are obvious reasons for that, you know, where I think you and I are both pretty, like, skeptical of advertising. But, or at least we're kind of like, we like to think about, like, the actual structural functionality of advertising, which is actually what I started to think about, because I was watching this thing on YouTube and I've noticed lately, I got rid of my premium YouTube account. I used to be pay for premium, which gets rid of the ads. And I've noticed since getting rid of premium that it's like the ads are like more and more, like they're like the interludes, the frequency of the ads in any given video is like higher than it ever used to be. And it's super annoying. And then I was talking about, and then I started thinking about some streaming services, like a streaming service that I had subscribed to for a while. I can't remember if I'm still subscribed to it. Where you would buy like the intro package. And Netflix is like this, it was Paramount, the one I'm specifically thinking about. I think Netflix is the same, where you buy like the lowest end package and you don't even get away from ads anymore. It just gives you access to the library, but you have to watch ads. But it's particularly interesting with the streaming services because the ads on the streaming services are advertisements for stuff in the library that you already purchased. They're not for external products. Now, YouTube is a little bit different because they are advertising external products, but it's more, what I started to think about was, I started to think about Aristotle's, you know, the four causes, you know, the material, final, formal, efficient, speaking specifically about the final, like what's the point of an ad, right? If I'm not watching ads, if many people, I believe, probably many listeners feel the same way, aren't looking at ads, specifically in these media mediums, I'll just like bracket, just talk about these sorts of things. What is the point of the ad? If the ad isn't to sell you something, like it's like, I'm not going to buy anything that's like advertised to me on YouTube. Or if as a matter of fact, like I'm not going to buy, like I've, and in the case of the streaming services, I have already purchased those items that they're advertising to me. So the efficient cause, like the reason that these ads there, that these mediums are active in this way, or the way that these companies are choosing to use these mediums is to annoy you, That is literally why they are there. And I thought that was such an interesting, it kind of took me, like, I kind of already knew this, but I was like, they're taking the medium of advertising and saying, look, like the actual ad itself is no longer important. The efficient cause is not to try and get people to purchase these items. Or, and again, with streaming services, you actually have purchased these items. Instead, what it's trying to get you to do is to be annoying to the point of you upgrading your subscription. So they're effectively advertising you not being annoyed. The product that they're actually trying to sell you is they're trying to sell you back your time, basically, or sell you your comfort or a better viewing experience. But they don't, obviously, like, they don't have to show, especially with the streaming services where you've already purchased the subscription. It's like, they don't have to do this. They just have decided that we're going to double tier this. And in the lower tier, we're going to use the medium of advertisements, and where the new efficient cause for advertisements is to get people to not to just upgrade their streaming service. And the same thing, I think, frankly, with YouTube, it's like, it's about trying to get you to buy the premium package. And I just thought that was just a really interesting way in which, you know, mediums can be used. Like, we think about ads as always being advertisements for something, but sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're not trying to sell you the thing that on face value that ad is about. Instead, it's more about how an ad structures and interrupts your life in such a way that you want to get rid of it. And they know that. They know ads are annoying. And so therefore, they're going to try and utilize that irritation to basically get at you, which, if our listeners can't tell, I found annoying. But I mean, I find it annoying to the point where I'm like, I'm not, like, I'm going to cancel my subscriptions. I'm not buying if you're going to try and do this to me. But it's just interesting how such a medium can be utilized in multiple different ways rather than its face value.
There's cases of this that are kind of similar in video games, but just interesting note as well. It's so interesting how well the medium itself veils that, well, let's call it form, right? Like, the purpose of the ad at this point is just to kind of put time delays between you accessing the content that you purchased, right? So, but it still has like an ostensible meaning, right? But this is an interesting case because that's where the ostensive meaning of the advertisement kind of breaks down when you really think about it. But it's interesting that it passes if you don't think about it, right? And that's just part of the structure of the ad itself is interesting. The other interesting thing too is I can't think of like a particular video game off the top of my head, but it's very easy to imagine like a free-to-play video game that gives you access. Like, I don't know, it's like a team-based game. They like last 20, 30 minutes. Free-to-play, you can play 2 or 3 rounds, but if you want to, like, 2 or 3 rounds per day, you can do your dailies or whatever. But if you really want to play all day, if you subscribe or you buy it or something, then you can keep playing. And you can, there are like innumerable cases of like, time wall, like paywalled access to playing content in video games. So I think that I think the use of time delays, but this specifically is, it's not just a time delay. It would be one thing if it's like, okay, wait 20 seconds or whatever, or like, hey, you have to schedule a time to access your content. That'd be one thing. But this is literally like, you go to it, you're standing in front of it, now an ad plays, and now you gotta wait 20 seconds. There's something like particularly annoying about the medium of advertising that they're exploiting.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of genius. It's very frustrating. But I think YouTube is annoying because of how frequent the ads are. Like, it's like we're just gonna like pump so many in here that it's like basically they're right getting on the cusp of making watching YouTube videos without a premium service unwatchable, right? Because it breaks up your content so much and all this kind of stuff, right? It's just so annoying. But I think that the streaming services one is like the most obviously egregious because, again, they are the things that they choose to advertise are themselves. It's the products that you have actually already purchased. Being like, oh, basically like, oh, great. Like, you've got like,